This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
This is from the All Marine Radio Quality Assurance Department. Good morning, Mac. The Queen of Soul and the King of Rock, the King of Rock and Roll, Elvis, share the same date of death, August 16th. They led such different lives, yet both were powerful musical influences. The one and only Beverly. She checks my shit all the time. I see her name in my inbox. I'm like, what did I screw up this time? But no, thank you to her. My stuff wouldn't work. The Watchtower is a Hendrix song. I'm not much of a Hendrix guy. But I like U2's cover of it. The Aretha Franklin passed away this morning at 9:50 a.m. Eastern Time in her home, surrounded by her family in the Detroit area of the state of Michigan. She had an advanced form of pancreatic cancer, pretty deadly cancer, and so again, thoughts and prayers. But again. Look, I mean, a life, we should all be so fortunate, right? No doubt a sad day for her family, but look, what an incredible life, what an incredible ride, that Aretha Franklin, had. And, her life should be held up. She lived it with class and with dignity. And was not a person that, I mean, and to a great extent, privacy, which is not easy to do in this day and age. So well done, Ms. Franklin. Well done. And she leaves behind her own children, her grandchildren, and, you know, and millions of fans around the world. So, again, breaking news this morning. But her voice is huge. Right. When I remember being young and when she would be on one of those award shows, right? She's a big woman, right? She'd come out there. She'd have that microphone and she would let it rip. You would just be like, whoa, check it out. And she had, honestly, she had this magical effect on live audiences. When I never saw her in person, but when you'd see her, you know, on TV live, and you'd see the way people would react to her presence. It was awesome. It was awesome. Top five stories in Early Bird this morning. Number one, how a dispute over a jailed American pastor roiled Turkey's economy. I don't understand this whole thing, right? I don't get why Turkey is holding on to this guy. My sense is Turkey's playing games because they want a Turkish cleric that's in the United States that they say is linked to the quote unquote coup attempt that wasn't much of a coup attempt, you know, and Venezuela just did something similar. Yeah, it was a coup attempt, but if that's your coup attempt, that's pretty lame, okay? Yeah. So we're going to take drones and we're going to drop some kind of explosives and we're going to think that's going to kill him? Right. Okay. I got it. Yeah. I don't know. It's, in my opinion, it looks like something staged by the government in power that they can then use to justify further clamping down on dissidents and people that are opposing him. That's just me. I'm not a revolutionary. I do play one on the radio at times. But, you know, the thing in Turkey was lame as shit, man. That's your attempt to take over the government? Whoa, like, I don't know. I don't want to tell you how to run your coups and all that. But unless you can make sure you're going to get them, you can't go. And if your idea is, okay, we're going to take a drone and we're going to drop some C4 and hopefully we're going to hit them on top of the head and it's going to explode perfectly and then we'll take over the government. Okay, like this is as stupid as the expansion of the ground war planning session in Afghanistan. Like, look, I'm not a coup guy, but as long as I'm sitting in here, let me give you some advice. If that's your plan, you guys are dumber than shit. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know. You look at that stuff and you're like, yeah, if that's as good as they got, then not very good. That is not very good. So, all right. So, relative to this pastor, okay. I just want, this article talks more about the economy and blah, 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 blah. Like, this American pastor, come on, man. Anyway, so that's number one. Two Air Force aircraft special operators helped drive Taliban out of Ghazni. One parajumper was wounded. A Taliban siege on the eastern city of Ghazni has reportedly been lifted, partially thanks to U.S. Air Force fighter bombers, drones, special operations airmen on the ground. On Friday, calling in airstrikes and things like that, right? So they go in with our partner forces, JTACs, calling in airstrikes, blah, 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 blah. And again, at first it's a big headline for the Taliban, right? Taliban are trying to take over Ghazni. At the end, it's the Taliban getting whacked, okay? So unless they're smart enough to, like, know when, like, enough is enough and get the hell out of there, what it turns into is a killing field. And, yeah, you're going to lose guys, but they're going to lose everybody that went in there unless they're smart enough to get the hell out of there. Following their assault in which the Taliban claimed they occupied government buildings, a military base, and a city prison, the insurgents were met by the U.S. military and Afghan government assets and melted back into the rural countryside. U.S. Air Force A-10, and again, the concern in all that is, why didn't you know it was coming? Do the people not trust you enough to tell you? Because surely they saw them coming. U.S. Air Force A-10, you love that A-10, it's a beast. B-1 bombers, F-16 fighters flew in support of the Afghan-led clearance operation, according to Martin O'Donnell, lieutenant colonel type, spokesman for U.S. forces in the country. Unmanned drones, such as the Reaper, which we love, also conducted strikes in support of ground forces. At least one U.S. service member, reportedly a pararescue jumper, assigned to an Army Green Beret team, was wounded in the fighting. Picture of him receiving a Purple Heart with some kind of wound to his arm was tweeted out by somebody. So congratulations to him on living and being part of the fire brigade. From a U.S. forces Afghanistan perspective, U.S. air power has killed more than 220 Taliban since Friday, O'Donnell said. In addition to the initial strike on Friday, U.S. forces conducted 5 strikes Saturday, 16 strikes Sunday, and 10 on Monday. And then hopefully, as you roll those guys up, right, you're grabbing cell phones and all those things, and you're sucking the life out of them, looking for numbers, seeing if they're active, and then it becomes a pursuit. And your soft guys are now targeting these numbers. You're looking for them operating on the satellite spectrum. You're looking for those SIM cards. Yeah. So, I mean, when it goes, it's going to go for days. So that's what, when these things start for us, it's a good thing. Yeah, it's a good thing because we get after it. Yeah. And they're going to get their initial headline, blah, 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 blah. Then we're going to kill them. And then we're going to do what's called sensitive site exploitation. Hopefully we kill some guys that are high up in the whole thing. And after we do that, boom, we're off. So yeah, once we do start grabbing cell phones and other computers and things like that that they have with them, then you're chasing them down and you're hopefully killing them, going into those sites, doing more, and you just keep pulling the string for as long as you can pull it. But again, the issue is, why is nobody telling us what's going on? What's going on in the vicinity of Ghazni? So, that a story. Number three, another story from Afghanistan. Gunmen attack a spy training center in Kabul. Now, this is a different attack, right? So there was an attack in Ghazni. There was another attack about 30 miles north of Kabul that started yesterday. And again, the same thing will happen there, right? Same thing will happen there. Taliban make a headline, and then they're going to get smoked. At least two gunmen have been killed while attempting to lay siege to an intelligence facility in the Afghan city of Kabul. A day before, scores of students were killed in an attack described by Rights Group as a war crime. Yeah, the suicide bomber walked into a university and kill about 50 and wound about twice as many. Gunmen on Thursday launched an attack on an intelligence training facility in Kabul. The assault is part of a wave of attacks across the country targeting security forces, which have left scores of soldiers, officers, and civilians dead. What we know, two gunmen were killed in the attack. No group has claimed responsibility. The training center is overseen by the National Security Directorate, Afghan's intelligence agency. The latest wave of attacks comes in the wake of a nationwide ceasefire between the Afghan government and the Taliban. So, Afghanistan. Next story. Number four, U.S. Army's future missile defense battle manager put to a test in a multi-domain operation. So the system developed by Northrop Grumman has to live and exist in cyber warfare as well as doing what it's supposed to do. And then there's number five is the president makes good on a threat to revoke John Brennan's security clearance by revoking it. A couple more stories in terms of overseas. One, Poland wants permanent U.S. forces stationed there. I love Poland, man. Yeah. Germany, not so much. Poland, yes. All right, and a couple more Marine Corps stories I wanted to get to. It's kind of caught my attention. Again, when we talk about Europe, more U.S. Marines to train in Norway and be closer to Russia. Russians don't like that, which is why I like it. Right? Screw the Russians. Another story. This is from Out of Task and Purpose. Exclusive. Two Marines received Valor Awards for secret gunfight against Al-Qaeda in North Africa. Two members of Marine Special Operations Command received Valor Awards for their heroism during a gunfight last year with Al-Qaeda militants in Northern Africa. A spokeswoman for U.S. Africa Command confirmed on Wednesday. While in a three-day operation to train, advise, and assist partner forces in the unnamed country, which the command withheld due to classification considerations, force protection, and diplomatic sensitivities, the Marine Special Operations Team on February 28th, 2017, a year and a half ago, became engaged in a fierce firefight against members of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. According to one of the award citation for the unnamed Marines who were often referred to as raiders. the two award citations for the Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal with Combat V were released in response for Freedom of Information Act by Task and Purpose. So, somebody familiar with the awards sent somebody at Task and Purpose an email and said, hey, you ought to check out, ask for the awards for these guys in this fight. So they file a Freedom of Information Act, DOD's got to respond to it, blah, 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 blah. Let me tell you, special operation guys are fighting all over the world. And sometimes it's a good thing. Too much secrecy, though, so again, is probably not a good thing. One more story out of Stars and Stripes. No injuries or damage were reported to two Marine tilt rotor aircraft that made separate precautionary landings in Japan. Okay, based in Okinawa. They landed for precautionary reason on the mainland. Okay. Big demonstration going on the other day on Okinawa, protesting American presence there. The aviation shit we have going on, oh my God, man. Come on. It's ridiculous. There was one more story I wanted to comment about. And I forgot. All right, I want to talk about space here for a minute, okay? So you're going to hear the Secretary of Defense talk about space. You've seen the headlines saying that Mattis contradicted himself, blah, 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 blah. He was against establishing the Space Force, and now he's for it. Trump rolled him, blah, blah, blah. So on, I don't even know what they call this aircraft, DOD-1. It's not Air Force One, but. So normally, whether it's the president or other, or the secretary of state hosting a, what's known as a gaggle, so they'll allow reporters to come in and they'll kind of shoot the shit with them. So what you have is essentially the secretary of defense sitting down with the Associated Press, and you'll hear him talk about the Space Force, right? So here you have it in his own words.
On the Space Force, from our earliest days, President Trump, Vice President Pence, and I, literally in my first month, this was a point of discussion about how do we organize for space. We are trying to define every challenge and then figure out what is the best solution for that. I was not against setting up a space force. What I was against was rushing to do that before we defined those problems. So we have had to do a lot of work defining the problem. It has to do with 10, 20 years in the future. Where do we want to be? What is our economic dependence on space? What is our intelligence? What do we have to do if we have to make it defensible instead of putting up satellites in a benign environment? I know it sounds like it should be done in time for 30 minutes when the time out for commercials. It doesn't work that way. It takes a lot of time.
There you have it. The complexities of space. Yeah, no, I've seen a couple programs that said, hey, why is space so important? Here's all the things that happen in your life that go through space. And the list is enormous. In fact, let me see. All the things that come from space in your life. So, no, not going to work. But no, but the list isn't crazy. Most crazy is all the financial transactions, ATMs, times, all that kind of stuff. All that fundamental stuff, they're all routed through space. Could you imagine if you couldn't get to an ATM? What? And you had to go to the bank? Yeah, you had to roll old school. We got to go by the bank. I've got to get some money. Yeah, no more ATMs. No more electronic transfers. Can't do it. Got to go check. Got to go to the bank, get cash. Yeah. That's crazy, right? Yeah, it's like, come on, that's a bygone era. And yet, that's what goes on through space. The Secretary of Defense is in, has been in the past week in Latin America. And so I'm going to play for you, I don't know, it's probably close to 30 minutes of the president spoke at the at Brazil's Escola Superior de Guerra. So that is Brazil's War College, all right, in Rio de Janeiro. He spoke, and then in his speech, that's where I saw the he started coughing, got some water, and he said, if this was rum, this would be a lot better speech. I'm like, ah, come on, man, bust out some new material. But anyway, don't tell him I said that. The Q&A is very interesting because they ask a wide array of questions, and I always love hearing him straight from the horse's mouth. So, from the horse's mouth, James N. Mattis, Secretary of Defense, United States, former Marine infantryman, former commander of CENTCOM, currently the man.
Stick with us, okay? So why don't we take some questions now? I understand, Anna, that you will be coming up. Thank you, Anna. And we're going to take some questions directly from you now, my fine young officer, to see if I'm on top of my game and you can ambush me with some good ones here.
Queremos a paz do debate, por gentileza. Quem quiser fazer uma pergunta, levante o braço e se identifique, por favor.
Go ahead. Oh, here we go.
So just be patient.
Rezende, professora de relações internacionais aqui na Escola Superior de Guerra e U.S. Scholar aqui no Brasil. A minha pergunta tem a ver com a declaração recente, semana passada, da criação de uma força espacial, ou seja, seria a quinta força armada norte-americana. E o que, segundo o meu entendimento, pode criar algum tipo de contradição, paradoxo, devido a compromissos já assumidos pela parte do governo norte-americano em administrações anteriores em relação à não militarização do espaço. Então, eu gostaria de ouvir o posicionamento oficial da Secretaria de Defesa justamente em relação ao que, ao meu entendimento, poderia provocar uma questão em relação ao direito internacional.
That's a long question, man. Come on. Is that a question or a statement, for good God?
Okay, excellent question. It has occupied a fair amount of my time over the last several months. Ladies and gentlemen, probably some years ago now, China sent a missile up and destroyed one of their own satellites in space. We understand the message that China was sending, that they could take out a satellite in space. Since then, our intelligence services have watched other nations, including Russia, develop a space attack capability where they can take satellites out in space. Now, you know how much of the world depends on communication through space, weather forecasting, environmental assessments of damage, of fires, whatever it is, from economics and trade to observation of natural phenomena and certainly intelligence and warning of any kinds of attacks, space has grown critical. So this is a reality. We are not initiating this. We are saying we will be able to defend our satellites in space. And at the same time, if someone is going to try to engage in space in military means, we will not stand idly by. We don't intend to militarize space. However, we will defend ourselves in space if necessary. It is a domain as real now as what our ancestors grew up with, the domain of the land and the water. And so we are going to have to adapt to that. We cannot look to fight the last war and think we are preparing to defend our people in the new environment. It's simply a reality. Until we can build the trust that space is, in terms of warfighting, sacrosanct, we would be unwise, we would lack prudence if we did not organize in this manner to protect ourselves. And in fact, this is one of the things that we want to deal with Brazil on, because you have a launch facility and you have a space technology aspect to your higher education that we believe is worthwhile. We have no intention of initiating operations in space contrary to other nations' use of it, but we've had enough demonstrations and enough intelligence now to know what is happening there that we have to adapt. I trust that gives you some of the background to what we're looking at. Other questions?
Próximo debatedor, Manoel Levy.
A minha pergunta é, na opinião de Vossa Excelência, qual seria o principal papel dos Estados Unidos no atual contexto geopolítico envolvendo o mar meridional da China? Obrigado.
So they asked a question, the translator is translating it, and then he's taking notes. Which is a technique that I would recommend to you when you speak in public and you're going to do Q&A stuff, write down the question, and then and normally as you're writing the question, you'll put a couple bullets of the answer that you want to give. You can get lost sometimes if you speak off the cuff. So if you do that or aspire to do it, I've watched him do that for a long time. Right, he's very thorough.
Yeah, thank you. It's an excellent question, again one that occupies a fair amount of my time. I went to Beijing 6 weeks ago to speak with my counterpart and the Chinese leadership. And here's the situation, ladies and gentlemen. There are features in the South China Sea that have never been militarized. They are areas that are claimed by a number of countries, Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, China, Taiwan. And we believe that any of those kinds of claims should be handled by diplomats. That's the way mature nations handle these things. It's called the rule of law. In this case, I was engaged with China from my first days in office. We met, Secretary of State and I, together with our counterparts in Washington, D.C. That was after we had an initial meeting in Mar-a-Lago in the first month in office, and we wanted to discuss this issue. Because right now, China is shredding the trust of the nations in the area by its muscular militarization. Further, in 2015, President Xi had come to America, and he had stated publicly with President Obama that there would be no militarization of the Spratly Islands. We invited China, when I came into office, to participate in the exercise RIMPAC, the largest naval exercise in the world, the one that Chile will be leading part of next year. They're already been put in charge and the planning's underway. They were invited, and a month before the exercise, China moved weapons into the Spratly Islands. After thinking about this and not getting any answers, the lack of transparency caused me to disinvite China. I was not happy with that. It's not what I wanted. I want transparency with China so that we all know what each other's doing, building stability. Remember, trying to keep the peace one more year, one more month, one more week. But I could not ignore the fact that they had done contrary to what their president had publicly promised and done it on the eve of the RIMPAC exercise. So in talking with the Chinese leaders, I explained that they were shredding trust, they were scaring nations, In some nations, they were even afraid to speak publicly about their fears because they feared Chinese economic exploitation and power. So I laid all this out to the Chinese, and I said, look, we're going to have to find a way where we can work together in this world, all of us, large nations, small nations, all nations being given the credit they're due, their sovereign decisions are permitted. We don't agree with every decision every nation makes. That doesn't change our respect for them and our willingness to work with them, unless it's some in some way aggressive against it. And so in laying this out, our hope is that we will find a way to work with China through diplomatic means to resolve issues like this. That's the way they should be resolved. And remember that China has signed and ratified UNCLOS. This was not some treaty made during their 100 years of humiliation. They were part of that treaty formulation. And under that treaty, they accept arbitration by a certain panel that was set up. That panel, for example, came out and said China was wrong and needed to return certain islands in the South China Sea to the Philippines. They discounted it and refused to abide by it. So at this point, where are we at it? On this, we are trying to press once again to maintain diplomatic solutions, as we should, and we are not going to agree to any restrictions on navigation. We send our Navy ships through the South China Sea routinely on what we call freedom of navigation patrols. The freedom of navigation there has benefited all nations in the world. These features were not under any attack, and they certainly did not need to be defended. China benefited in its economic rise from the freedom of navigation that all nations, large and small, enjoy. So we want to return it to that status that it was before, and there is no need for militarization of those islands. I have too much respect for the Chinese officers and the People's Liberation Army Navy, to think that they suspect any invasion of China is coming. You know, and I know, that is not possible. So we're going to have to settle this diplomatically, is the bottom line.
Now, this is just 2 days ago, Secretary Mattis in Brazil at the Brazilian War College. He's already delivered his remarks. This is part of the Q&A. Right off the bat, asked about space, asked about the South China Sea. So up next should be Russia. We'll see. But, you know, it's I love these kind of things where he speaks in long format in public.
Bom dia, especialista em revolução. Eu gostaria de saber qual a política dos Estados Unidos frente à Shanghai Cooperation Organization e a possibilidade de formação de uma organização antagônica à OTAN. Desculpa. Qual a política dos Estados Unidos frente à Shanghai Cooperation Organization e a possibilidade de formação de uma organização antagônica à OTAN?
If I understand the question, vis-a-vis NATO, NATO, as you know, is 29 democracies that look to the natural defense of all nations there. This is one of the ways that we've maintained peace and stability in NATO since 1949. And the way to answer your question is to put it in the context, why did the greatest generation coming home from World War II look around and say we were raised in an economic depression, a worldwide depression? There was a war in which millions, tens of millions of people were killed. They come home to America and they say, what a crummy world that was. And they say, but we're part of it, whether we like it or not, and we're going to set up international organizations that respect sovereignty, that protect democracy. And out of that grows the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, so nations that are in economic trouble do not have to turn to Mussolini or a fascist as a lender of last resort.
Okay, now, when he says that, that's a veiled reference to what China is doing today, right, with their Belt and Roads. Look, we'll give you lower interest rates, but we come with it. So interesting answer as he begins to articulate the international infrastructure that has gone with into the post-World War II era that has created a ton of stability in the world, right? And now, again, there's certainly issues with emerging nations, but interesting. Interesting, and the emerging nations will have a different perspective on this, but interesting as he talks about in not so veiled ways China.
We've created NATO, and NATO, as the Australian ambassador to Washington once taught me, was the single biggest self-sacrificial act in world history. And I thought I knew history, and I'm looking at the ambassador. Not sure what he was saying. And he said, the United States in 1949 could have said, we're done with you, Europe. You've brought us into two world wars. We've lost hundreds of thousands of our lads. You lost troops here in Brazil. We are going to stay in North America and South America. We're going to work with Asia. We're done with you. We're going to work with Africa. We could have created the markets there. Instead, with the Marshall Plan, we reached out to help rebuild those democracies in Europe that had been flattened by war. And we said, we are going to pledge our security and 100 million dead Americans in a nuclear war to protect you so that the Soviet Union cannot attack. So go back to those days and think about how we put this world order together to protect democracy. The United Nations is not perfect, but it gives us a place to talk our issues. And we have avoided major, major war in the years since. So where an organization like this rises, if it contributes to that stability, if it contributes to sovereignty of nations large and small, if it helps nations when they go through hard times, then it's a contributor to international stability. But we stand fast with the idea that these international organizations, these alliances, the rule of law, the respect for each other comes first. You can't use predatory economics and pile massive debt on a country and then remove its sovereignty over its port, like in Sri Lanka, if you see what I'm driving at. So where it contributes,
like in Sri Lanka with the Belt and Road Initiative, right, becoming enslaved to China's debt and then their demands. So, again, I love when he goes out here and teaches this kind of stuff and links it to current events.
If it gets to respect for others and prosperity for others, then we support it. But we do not believe that economic compulsion should then take away a nation's sovereignty. There's more than one way to lose your sovereignty. It's not just by bayonets. It can also be lost by economic domination. And that would be my concern. But right now, I'll just stay in a theoretical mode to answer your question, man. But thank you.
Próximo debatedor, por gentileza.
That was theoretical. Kind of, sort of, maybe not.
Coronel Xavier, curso de altos estudos em política e estratégia da ESG. Senhor secretário, eu gostaria que o senhor compartilhasse a sua visão como secretário de defesa sobre o estado final desejado das relações estratégicas do Brasil e dos Estados Unidos na próxima década.
Okay, excellent question. In our military role, we always want to know where are you going? What is the objective? What is the outcome? And then we organize ourselves accordingly. The first point I would make is Brazil occupies by geography by economics, by being a democracy, a leading role in our hemisphere, in North and South America. This is a reality. It is historically based, and Brazil may go through tough times at times like all countries, but Brazil will be a leader in South America. So what we need to do is see where our interests converge. First of all, we want economic prosperity for everyone. That's the way you take care of your people. Secondly, we want safety. And we recognize that safety cannot come. There is no single nation in this world that can provide for its own security. It cannot happen. If you think if you just think back to 9/11, where we lost over 3,000 innocent people murdered, innocent citizens of 91 countries died in New York City that day for absolutely no conceivable rationale. It was absolute murder. And that had nothing to do with what originated in New York City. So what we have learned over the years, Syria, Afghanistan, problems in ungoverned areas do not stay there. So how do you deal with the world, a globalized world, where those problems can come home to Europe, come home to Latin America, to North America? We want a relationship with Brazil that is a partnership, that has exchanges of officers, so we get your good ideas like I benefited from in 1972, and you benefit from our experiences, our schools. We want exchanges between the schools, so we stay at the front edge. Democracies have no God-given right to victory, to protection, to success on the battlefield. It comes down to what level of commitment do you make to your chosen profession? Tactical commitment, logistics, intelligence, operational, ethical commitment. We want best to have our forces working together at whatever level is consistent with your national interest. That is a sovereign decision for you that we will respect because we're a fellow democracy. We do not believe it's something that we should dictate. It's why when I chose four schools worldwide to learn from to make the changes I want to make in mine, this is one of those schools. That's one of the part of our strategic vision that we're learning from you. Also, if trouble looms, we want to be standing with you. You're a fellow democracy, just like you stood with us when we got thrown into World War II. Does that answer your question, sir?
Thank you.
Sure. You're welcome.
Próximo debatedor, Coronel Geraldo José.
Coronel Geraldo José, médico da Força Aérea Brasileira. Excelência, eu gostaria de saber quais as oportunidades que surgem no horizonte a partir da fusão de duas empresas, notadamente de defesa, uma importante para o país de Vossa Excelência e uma importante para o país, meu país, a Boeing e a Embraer. Obrigado.
Yes. I mentioned in my remark, thank you, Colonel, I mentioned in my remarks, we believe it is in America's, the United States' best interest and the America's hemisphere's best interest that your defense industry be competitive. Right now, the U.S. Navy has just chosen a new missile, a standard missile, surface missile. That missile is made by Norway and the United States together. What we find is when we marry ourselves to other democracies and their advances, we actually go faster in our own technological achievements. So what we want to do is make sure that where we can do the same with Brazil, where we can advantage Brazil and the United States at the same time, it's a two-way street. We're not trying to take over an industry. We see a value to keeping alive in other democracies their defense industries, so we're never in a position where the democracies are in second place in terms of defense technology. So this to us is simply emblematic. It's simply a model of where we are very interested in what can we achieve together. I am prohibited by law from making comments about specific defense contracting and that sort of thing. It's part of our way of making certain our military armaments industry and the Defense Department have no hint of corruption inside them. We're very, very strict about it. So I can't go into more detail, but the theme I can speak to very strongly. And I mean, I come from a Marine Corps that for all my 40 years in the Marine Corps was flying a British-made jet, the Harrier jet, the short takeoff jet. So we are very familiar with the idea of doing the best we can with our own equipment, but not being blind to the advantages of foreign equipment. So that's where we want to go, and I can't speak to the specific company you spoke to, but that's where we're at thematically. I like these questions, by the way. You're asking good ones. You know, I enjoy this. Who else has a question?
Próximo debatedor, General Dil, comandante da CN.
General Dil, comandante das Forças Comandas, Estado do Norte do Exército. General Met, se eu não estiver enganado, o senhor é o primeiro militar que ocupa o cargo de secretário de defesa desde George Marshall. Aqui no Brasil, o nosso Ministério da Defesa é mais recente, tem apenas 19 anos, e nós estamos no 11º ministro, que é o General Silvio Luna, desde o início desse ano. Por motivos ideológicos, houve muita crítica da imprensa ao fato do General Silvio Luna, um militar de carreira, ter ocupado o cargo de ministro da Defesa. Eu gostaria de saber a opinião do senhor sobre o fato de militares ocuparem cargos em equipes governamentais, particularmente como ministro da Defesa ou outras missões correlatas.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, sir. I had a fine retirement program going. I was at Stanford University. If you can believe this, they don't even turn on the coffee pot there until 9:30 in the morning. Amazing. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I took no part in the political campaign. Had never met Mr. Trump before. And I got the phone call after he was elected and before he was in office, asking me to come back for an interview. And, you know, we come from the military, and we have a kind of a saying in America, if the President of the United States asks you to do something, whether you're on active duty or retired, you don't go up like Hamlet and start wringing your hands, and you don't look out, well, I'd rather have a nice life, Republican or Democrat. The answer is yes, sir, or yes, ma'am. There is no equivocation. Now, I was the first, in order to be in that job, our law required you to have been out of the military for at least 7 years. This allows young people who join the military spend a couple of years and then leave. Of course, they can be made the Secretary of Defense many years later. I'd only been out a little over 3 years, so the U.S. Congress, both the House and the Senate, had to give me a waiver, and then the Senate, of course, held a hearing, and I had to go up and answer questions, and they voted for me, and I was very fortunate in that vote that I got. We have 100 senators. One was not present because he'd been selected to be the Attorney General, and I got 98-1 on the vote, so I passed. My point is that we still maintain civilian control over who can be the Secretary of Defense. That is never in question. I think that it is wrong in America, in the United States of America, to say as a retired general or admiral to come out in a public position supporting one candidate or another. The reason is we do not want to politicize the officer corps, and I don't want anyone thinking when they have a general in the room, well, he retires next year, I wonder what he's going to do after that. You see what I mean? So that's why I took no part in the campaign. I don't believe I should. I kept my mouth shut publicly 100%. But at the same time, I think that it is essential that when you're called upon to serve in a democracy, you roll up your sleeves and you do your best. And you go in and you
maintain the duties of your office, guided, I think, in many ways by the ethical precepts that we were raised on, that make certain that we are doing things for the good of the country and the defense of the Constitution. And so long as you stay guided by the values that formed you when you were young, in the future, I don't think there's any problem with serving. We just have to be very careful that we don't participate, I think, in campaigns, election campaigns, where we feel, whether on active duty or a retired status, that our guy or gal won or lost. It's whatever the people decide, then we support the Constitution and we stay true. We stay loyal to the Constitution. And I'm not in any way against them serving. I would be very much against them taking a political role in a campaign.
Interesting. You know what? Again, my position is I would rather have them speak in public politically than this go from the DOD into this defense thing that you see all the time. I don't think that's right. So I think the extension of what Secretary Mattis says is a prohibition. If you've reached the status of being a general officer or a flag officer in the American military, you are prohibited from working in the defense industry. Yeah, how about that? So if you want to be a monk, be a monk. But I don't think it's like you can't speak in public, but you can go into this world of billions of dollars of defense. To me, I don't care for that. And of the two, the least threatening to the democracy, in my opinion, is to speak in public, where we can all have at your ass, as people did with John Allen during the presidential campaign. And so again, I partially agree with him, and I partially disagree.
Temos tempo para uma última pergunta, por gentileza, último debatedor.
Bom dia, secretário. Tenente Coronel Márcio Rezende, do curso de Estado-Maior Conjunto. Secretário, o senhor fez menção ao 9/11, então pergunto se existe alguma nova estratégia de enfrentamento ao terrorismo e se o senhor visualiza o Brasil inserido nessa nova estratégia.
You know, Colonel, many of the best, I thank you, many of the best ideas I get on this are found in old books. And I think that in these wars among the people, as a British officer has called them, in these wars among the people, it's probably most important that you imbue your, in my case, my youngest sailors and Marines and eventually soldiers and airmen with an ethical sense, with guidance that allows them to make sense in the chaos of a battlefield where our enemies in many cases today hide purposefully behind women and children to draw fire on them, who violate any kind of code of chivalry. It's very important that your youngest troops have touchstones and make certain that those touchstones reflect the larger strategy of protecting innocent people while stopping the terrorists. I can remember telling my young guys when I wore a uniform, if in order to kill a terrorist you have to shoot across a crowded marketplace, don't take the shot. Don't take a chance of injuring a woman or child, because that you don't want to live with this.
The saying was, first do no harm. He's famous for that. All those little things that chunk a very complex thought into something small, guardian angels, no better friend, no worse enemy, first do no harm. All those are things that he believed in, that they were great tools for young Marines in particular, that reduced to a few words a very complex thought that they had been given classes in and were constant reminders in. He's talking about keep your honor clean.
Plus, you know it will create more enemies if you do so. So hunt them down another day and do your duty, but don't take any chances. You have to have in your strategies today a human touch that goes down to your youngest soldier on the front lines so they know what to do. Because any time you put troops into this situation, whether domestically or internationally, in a coalition against an enemy in a faraway country, you're putting them into ethically uncertain waters, because not all of the contradictions that they're going to face can be sorted out and trained. They're going to trust to them. The most important thing is to ensure that from the very top political leadership who sends those troops to that fight or to that peacekeeping mission, that there is clarity down to the youngest troops out there about what the mission is and what you stand for, and just as much so, what you do not stand for. But there is a caution I would share with you as you focus in this counterterrorism area and the strategies to make it work. Don't forget the young troops who are out there who are going to have to actually put this in practice. They're going to make mistakes. It's simply reality in these kind of circumstances. And whatever strategy you put together, you're going to have to persevere and know the difference when one of your troops makes a mistake, and stand by them and work on coaching them better and training them better and lessons learned. And what is a lack of discipline, which we should never tolerate in our ranks. But do not hold every mistake as something where you condemn them when a matter of moments they had to make the decision. Now, why do I take this strategic question of yours down to such a tactical level? Because counterterrorism can at times tear a military itself apart. We have seen this in wars in the 20th century and certainly in the 2000s. And I think you have to be sure that when you put together a strategy, it can be carried out, because it's probably not going to be something you can execute in 9 months or even 229 days of combat in Italy. It's going to take years, because you're going to have to address some of the underlying issues. So recognize that we're going to have to address it. It's going to have to be multilateral, multinational, because that's the nature of this threat. And also recognize that it's exceedingly difficult to be the young lieutenants and sergeants and privates out there trying to carry it forward. I think at times, sometimes the strategic discussions are bloodless. They don't recognize there's innocent people that you're trying to protect that are in jeopardy out there, and your own troops are going to have to take risks with their own lives in order to carry this out in an ethical manner. So that is probably one of the messages I would want to bring home. We've also done some writing in the U.S. Army, which is most advanced on this, where the Army and the Marines put together their lessons learned into the counterinsurgency manual. And that's where you turn that strategy into the reality on the battlefield. But I think it's very, very important that the ethical dimension for your own troops and for the battlefield, humanitarian field, be addressed inside the strategy and not added on as tragedies mount up. You've got to think about this as you go in. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm getting the nod that it's time to leave. But again, I would just tell you, I appreciate you offering me the opportunity to be here. While I don't know you personally, again, I do know your character. I know why I stuck around that low-paying Marine infantry.
That is the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis. Interesting. You know, again, he was a commanding authority during Haditha. And so you hear his comments now talking about the ethical, how it lays down, and not to forget those young soldiers and Marines, in our case, that go into harm's way to execute a counterinsurgency strategy that is a million shades of gray. So very interesting. I honestly love, whether it's he or General Dunford, General Kelly as well, when he used to do it. When they do long format stuff, I could listen to it most of the day. Maybe not all day, But I love every once in a while kind of catching up with him with some of the things that he's done. So that was the Secretary of Defense. He was in Brazil. He gave a speech before he did the Q&A. And again, it's interesting. He tries to talk in theoretical terms, but they're not when he's talking about destruction of satellites and the South China Sea. It's not very theoretical, right? We're talking about China. We're talking about Russia. And so, you know, again, I enjoy at times his frankness. And then, you know, then he says, look, you know, we have competing interests. We understand that. But, you know, the desire to live by, for instance, the Law of the Sea, which is a treaty that the Chinese helped draft and sign. And then they turn their back on it when it's not convenient. So so it's interesting to hear him kind of lay out for different people. I don't know there's a more credible member of the U.S. administration than the Secretary of Defense. I think he is a bit of a celebrity around the world because of his colorful kind of American Western image, but also because of his incredible experience over the course of the last decade, and then, you know, you layer on the rest of his career as well. So always interesting to hear him talk in long format. We're going to take a break. When we come back, that's right, he himself will join us. He's one and only Gunner. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.